Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. We want to go back into our archives now and listen to an excerpt of an NPR report from 1981. By reporter Lori Garrett. It's NPR's first report on a mysterious disease that some called a cancer that was striking young gay men in cities across the country.
In the last 3 months, 28 cases of Kaposi's sarcoma have been reported in this country, all occurring among gay men, most of them young. Every man suffering from Kaposi's sarcoma also has an unusual viral infection. It's called cytomegalovirus, and it may be connected to this puzzling new cancer outbreak.
That puzzling cancer, of course, was AIDS, and the disease went on to claim the lives of some 34 million people over the years. But back in 1981, it was little known and even less understood. That was the year that Michael Ward met Mark Halberstadt. They fell in love, and after 3 years together, Mark was diagnosed, becoming one of the earliest clients of Boston's AIDS Action Committee. Michael Ward writes about this in his new memoir titled The Sea Is Quiet Tonight. And Michael Ward joins us in studio. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you for having me.
So paint the picture for us, if you would, what it was like when you met Mark back in the early 80s, and why did he stand out to you?
I met him at something called Tea Dance, which is a big outdoor dance in the Pines in Fire Island. And there was just something about him. He was small and wiry and very self-contained, which is, I'm much more extroverted. And there was something very appealing about that. And he very cleverly moved me out of the crowd and out for a walk. And it went on from there.
Mm. And how old were you then?
I was 37 and he was 39.
And what was sort of the atmosphere like then? Describe what it was like to be a 30-something gay man and at that time. You know, it certainly was very different.
It was very different. 81 was so different. I mean, I grew up in the Midwest with a lot of homophobia, and I got involved in New York in the gay rights movement. And we fought very hard for what we felt were our rights. And that also translated in, I mean, liberation translated into sexual and excessive behavior, let me say. Mm-hmm. And I had been in one relationship for 4 years, which had ended not bitterly, but ended. And I was still, I'm a relationship kind of guy. I mean, I was still looking for the right man.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But at the time, would you say that, you know, it was openly hostile? I mean, what was the environment like? And there are a lot of people who may not remember what it was like in 1981.
There was a lot of homophobia. When I moved to Boston in 79 from Princeton, I was assaulted the first weekend that I was in Boston on the street. I was walking down the street with my former partner who had helped me move, and I had my hand on his shoulder, and a guy stopped his car and got out and came out swinging. And I stepped in front of Frank to block him, and he broke my glasses. And I was just shocked. I mean, I'd never experienced anything like that before.
Oh, my God.
Boston was full. I was spit on in those early years. People threw beer bottles. If we'd be waiting in line to go into a bar, they'd throw beer bottles. There was a lot of overt, hostile, abusive behavior.
And that was here, which
here
was considered, not, you know, certainly we're not talking, you know, some backwater place.
It wasn't anything. Little Rock. It was Boston. Yeah.
Right. So I can't imagine then what it was like to have to deal with AIDS at the time. So that this is all coming into the awareness at the time. And you're, what were
yes.
you thinking?
Well, I thought it belonged somewhere else. Really.
What do you mean? Like
well,
another country?
Well, yeah, preferably another planet. Yes. But the stories that we heard were about New York and Boston. Mark was from New York, and so he moved up here to live with me. And he knew people. The first people we knew who got sick were, one was a business partner of his. But we didn't know what it was. It was just, oh, my God, Boyd got sick and died in 2 months. And it was bizarre. But when the numbers started mounting up, it became very creepy.
I'm wondering if you could read a passage from your book for us. It's when you and Mark are discussing the possibility that he might have this new disease called AIDS that was sort of in the, that you wished was on another planet.
Yes, yes. So this, in the book, this is just before he was actually diagnosed. He said, "I worry about AIDS." It was the first time he had ever used that word in relation to himself. I could hardly breathe. "We can't be having this conversation," I thought. We were lying naked facing each other, and I held his gaze, pushing my panic down. "From what I've read, if you had it, you'd know it. None of your symptoms are extraordinary." "I know, but this cough isn't going away. My breathing is affected. Maybe it's time to see a specialist. I'm going to call Cesar at his office this afternoon and ask him to get me a referral." Throughout his narration, Mark's voice was without emotion, whether for his own sake or mine, I didn't know. "Good idea. Maybe he'll reassure you. I just don't think your symptoms are bad enough." But the black cloud that I'd felt hovering before felt terribly close. We still didn't know anyone personally in Boston with AIDS, but we knew from friends that there had to be 50 or 60 men already diagnosed. The next morning, running too fast along the dirt path on the Cambridge side of the river, I stumbled and nearly fell. I sat down in the grass, panting like a dog. "He's not afraid he's going to get AIDS, Mike. He's afraid he already has it." I was soaked with sweat. Oh, dear God, what if he really is sick? I had tried to avoid reading the New York Native articles, believing that they didn't have anything to do with me. Could I really have been blind all these months? Feeling unsteady, I got up and slowly walked back home.
Wow, very powerful. So was that, would you say that those were common emotions at the time? A lot of denial.
Oh, yes.
People just didn't believe it was. So when you heard these stories about this weird cancer and you saw people that you knew were dying, it still was easy to put it away somewhere. It wasn't going to happen to me. Is that what you were thinking?
It wasn't going to happen to me. And I know this sounds bizarre, but it wasn't going to happen in Boston, even though I had heard stories about people being diagnosed in Boston. The whole thing, I mean, think of an epidemic now starting with a few people and then a few hundred people, and then a few thousand people across the country. And you'd think, oh, this is just, you know, whatever it is, they'll figure it out.
Right. Yeah, he was obviously eventually diagnosed.
Yes.
And you write about visiting him, where you had to go into a room completely, dressed in almost protective gear,
yes,
if you will. What,
yes,
what was that like?
Very, very creepy. The worst thing, the worst part about it for me was that he was so distressed when we would come in wearing gowns, masks, covers on our head, gloves, and he couldn't tell one person from another. He said he felt like a leper.
Oh, boy. So what kind of support did you find here in Boston at the time?
Miraculously, in terms of timing, Larry Kessler had just started the AIDS Action Committee when Mark was diagnosed. Mm. And also, Dr. Jerome Groopman had just moved here from Los Angeles, and he was totally on top of what little anybody knew. Mm-hmm. So we had very good support from organizations that were just beginning to pull themselves together.
How did the AIDS Action Committee support you then? Am I correct in this number here? Mark was the 100th
person in Massachusetts to be diagnosed.
Okay. And so what kind of support did you get from this fledgling agency known as the AIDS Action Committee in the 80s, right?
Well, Larry showed up at the hospital, and which he did with every person who was diagnosed, and asked, what kind of support do you have? Do you need help at home? As the organization got more organized and more developed, you know, they ended up having hundreds and hundreds of volunteers. And but Mark was the first in all of it. He was in the very first People with AIDS group. He was the first person to be on the Mayor's Council on AIDS.
And how long did Mark live from the time of diagnosis until the time he passed?
10 months.
Yeah, so it was very fast.
Very fast. It, in a certain way, it felt like 100 years because we were really in the day every day. And every day we believed that they were going to find a cure until the last month or so.
What about you? Were you concerned for your own health because of this?
I think denial is a very powerful defense in my psychological system. And I felt like I didn't have time. I was so worried about him, and there were so many things he was unable to do that I was sort of creating a life for both of us while he was sick. And as he got sicker, it took more and more energy.
Mm. At one point in the book, though, you said you did get a positive return.
I did.
An HIV test.
Yeah.
What happened there, and how did you feel?
I was in the first study group that Robert Gallo did in Washington for the, it was then called HTLV-3 virus. And when I got the test back, I wasn't distraught. I mean, it's very strange. When Dr. Groopman told me, he told me with Mark, and I thought he was coming in to say they had found another drug to keep Mark alive. So when he told me that the news he had was that I was not positive, I was negative, I felt disappointed. I thought it was going to be something else. And then I really, you know, I worried about it occasionally, but I was very busy with him. Hmm. And then right before Mark died, we found out that the test had been a false positive.
You know, your relationship with Mark, as you write, was tumultuous.
Oh, it was.
How do you think his illness affected that? Would it make you almost closer?
Absolutely. Mm. I mean, again, it was a godsend that we had gone into couples therapy and got some really good help in sorting out the difference between someone who is extremely extroverted and somebody who's extremely introverted. And we were very allied by the time he got his diagnosis, so I never once thought about leaving.
Why write this book now, all these years later?
I needed to write it. I retired 3 years ago, and for all the years, he's been dead almost 33 years now. Mm. And that scene in the preface of going to call his parents in the waiting room was in my mind from the day it happened, in terms of if I ever write about this, that's where I'm going to start. Mm-hmm. So when I stopped working, it was cathartic for me to go. I had never reread my journals from those years. And I went back and reread everything and did a substantial amount of crying. And then began to put it together and thought, I can do this. I can write a book.
Right. But what about the story? What do you hope the story does for people
now?
Now, because now, it's a very different time right now.
It's a very different time now.
So do you want to tell them what did AIDS teach the world, or what was it like, or what?
I think more what was it like, for a couple of reasons. The feedback that I've gotten from people who worked in the epidemic, like Larry Kessler and Peter Lombardi, who ran the Buddy program, is that they had, like me, they had so much affect, depressed and undigested from the epidemic that they cried all through the book. And I think a lot of the survivors who were also caretakers are responding in a very emotional way. But I'm also really interested in young people reading it, because the numbers for adolescents are up 26% for HIV infection.
Oh, really?
2 adolescents a day are being diagnosed in the United States with HIV. Because they believe that now that they know that there are medications you can take, they say, well, I can just take medication. But they don't understand that they're then subject to a lot of other illnesses, and they'll be affected their whole lives.
Okay. Michael Ward, retired psychotherapist, author of the new memoir, The Sea is Quiet Tonight. There's more information about the book at our website, radioboston.org. Michael, thanks for coming in.
Thanks so much.
That's it for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Deborah Becker, and this is Radio Boston. Thank you.